Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Scuttlebutt. I'm your host, Sean Hall, Director of Programming with the Veterans Breakfast Club. We're a nonprofit in Western PA whose mission is to create communities of listening around veterans and their stories to connect, educate, heal, and inspire. You can find out everything there is to know about the VBC on our website, www.veteransbreakfastclub.org. On there, you can find out about our upcoming in-person breakfast that we hold here in Western PA, our online programs. We have an online happy hour every Monday night at 7 p.m. Eastern time. It's as easy as clicking the Zoom link and jumping in the room. We're always talking military topics, military history with authors, historians, veterans, and non-veterans such as myself are always encouraged to attend to help bridge that military-civilian divide and learn more from our servicemen and women. Today on the Scuttlebutt, I will have on the Director of Veteran Services, Brian Pichel. Brian was an Army medic. He was in from 04 to 09, and he deployed to Iraq in 2005. During this deployment, he was conducting and training route clearance missions, basically IED hunters. And as you can imagine, it's a pretty rough detail. Brian came back, had experiences with PTSD. He refound his passion for volleyball and coaching, and then he found Dogs for Our Brave. Dogs for Our Brave, a wonderful nonprofit organization, and their mission is to provide professionally trained service dogs at no cost to veterans who have suffered debilitating injury or illness while in service to our country. Their goal is to rescue dogs at every opportunity, thus saving two lives at once. And in order to fully realize this mission without adding financial burden to the veteran, they also provide a full life continuum of care for the dog. It covers all their food, covers veterinary care, covers pharmaceuticals. This is an incredible organization, and I had a great conversation with Brian talking not only about his service, but what Dogs for Our Brave means to him and to the people that they've been able to help. I hope that you enjoy this conversation, and thank you so much for enjoying our podcast. You can always reach out to me, Sean, S-H-A-U-N, at veteransbreakfastclub.org, and please like, share, subscribe, and ring the bell on YouTube so you're the first to know whenever we release new episodes. Thank you so much, and enjoy the show. Joining me now is Brian Pichel. Brian, you're coming to us from Dogs for Our Brave. You are the Director of Veteran Services, but you are also in the Army. I'd love for you to introduce yourself. Welcome to the Scuttlebutt. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks, Sean, for having me. Thanks for allowing me to, the platform to speak about the organization, speak about veterans' issues. We know there's a lot of them out there, and the more of us that are having good conversations about it, hopefully brings awareness, but more importantly, starts bringing action. I think that's what all of us are looking for, is to create action, to start us help, create the help that's so desperately needed within the veteran community.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I'm just grateful for the opportunity here, and look forward to diving into some good conversation.
Excellent. Well, let's kick it back to 04. You joined the Army in 04. What made you decide to enlist?
I'm a 9/11 guy, essentially. I was actually coaching collegiate volleyball at the time when 9/11 occurred. That just sat on me for a while. I have a father that served in the Army. He was a reservist. My brother ended up enlisting in the Marines after he graduated from college. So that calling was there. Obviously, we were at war, and being a young, able-bodied male, I was single at the time, had no kids, anything of that nature. And I'm like, okay, if I don't do this, I know I'm going to regret it for the rest of my life. So that ultimately I, without really having conversations with anybody, my family, I left everybody out of this. I was a big boy and I needed to make this decision. But I went down and I enlisted, and that was the start of it from there. So I knew I wanted to be a medic. That was the only job I wanted. It's where I felt I could be of the most service. So, yeah, I enlisted in October of 2004, took up for basic training, got through basic, got through AIT. I had some medical training, so they cut off like 6 weeks of my AIT training.
Yeah.
And by May of 2005, I was, assigned to my unit at Fort Leonard Wood. Ironically, being a St. Louis guy, I get stationed 2 hours from home, which was pretty funny.
Yeah.
I was gone to Iraq by November of that year. So fortunately I was assigned to a combat engineer unit. which was one of two deployable units on Fort Leonard Wood at the time, which I was, you know, I enlisted because I wanted to go over. I didn't want to get stuck in a hospital. I would have obviously done whatever, you know, my orders were, you know, typed up for, but, you know, I wanted to be in the fight. I was afforded that opportunity with the 5th Engineers. But we ran route clearance. That was our job. And we actually ran the route clearance training academy in Baghdad. So along with running missions, we were also training everybody up on route clearance. So IED searching for everybody that came into country from November of 04 to, sorry, November of 05 to November of 06.
So how old were you when you enlisted?
24.
Oh, I was an old man. I was going to say, so you were the old guy.
I was the old guy. I was the old, and I heard there was a core of us in AIT that I think there were about 8 to 10 of us that were all, you know, in that, you know, 24, 25, 26 age range. And we all kind of hung together. we were like, look, we knew exactly what we were doing. We weren't looking to stand out in any way. Let's just get through the training and let's get to our units and let's get to work. So it was always entertaining having conversations with those guys because, you know, you see the young guys that are pushing PT scores and I got to be the top of my class. And all of us are just like, yeah, no, we just want to get through training. Let's get us to our units and let's get to work.
Right.
My senior.
Go ahead.
No, it was just funny because I, you know, we got to graduation. My senior drill sergeant was like, are you even in my platoon, crazy? Like, he didn't know my name, had no clue who I was, which was kind of how you wanted it in training, right?
Yeah, right. If they know your name, you're in trouble.
Typically. Yeah.
Right. And what was your plan prior to 9/11? Had you even considered the military prior to that?
Not really. I mean, it was never out of the question, but you know, I was coaching college. And that was my life plan, was to coach. I had coached volleyball for several years at that point. After I'd finished playing, I'd had a couple knee surgeries. So it shortened my playing career, whatnot. So I really had no serious intention, but again, 9/11 altered that course pretty quickly. I just knew it was the right thing to do. I knew I was going to regret it if I didn't do it.
Yeah.
So.
Now, was it, you got to Iraq, 05. What was it like when you first landed there and you said you wanted to get in on the action? Was it immediate or, you know, was there sort of a learning curve? Yeah.
It was immediate. Especially with our mission, with us taking over the route clearance mission within Baghdad. And we were a division asset, when push came to shove. So we actually ended up covering ground all over the country. But being one of the lead route clearance units in country, we assisted the 101st, Marine units. I mean, you name it. We were covering down on everybody. So, and obviously, I think everybody knows that, you know, the IED situation in Iraq at that time was quite significant, to say the least. It didn't take us long before I found out real quick. You know, luckily I was, you know, the battalion I was with had a lot of seasoned NCOs. And that came into play throughout the entire course of the deployment because it ended up being a very challenging deployment. I was hoping to see some action and be a part of the fight, and we got it. It's a little bit different. You know, you get these, the infantry piece, you know, a lot of those guys are on the ground and they're clearing houses and going through city block by block, which is just a different level of intensity in and of itself. Yeah. And then what we do is we're rolling around in these vehicles driving 5 miles per hour for 10, 12, 16, 18 hours, depending on how long the mission is and where we have to go. And just staring out the side of the road, staring out the window and waiting for something to happen, you know, cause after a while we realized it wasn't a question of if you were going to get hit. It was a question of when. Mm-hmm. We found out pretty quickly. I think it was my second mission out the gate. We got hit with an IED. That's when it became real.
I was going to ask when did it become real? And do you remember it?
Yeah. I mean, when we landed, it was, I actually got besides being the newest medic on, you know, within the battalion, they actually sent me with the advanced party to help set the battalion up. So I built a lot of trust within the unit pretty quickly. I think just probably because I was one of the old guys, even though being a, you know, a new, you know, recruit, I was one of the old guys, so I had some maturity with me, but, you know, my senior NCO, you know, had enough trust there. So I got to go over, you know, with the advanced party and help set up the battalion and whatnot, get a lot of the medical pieces in place, connect with a lot of the doctors and the physician's assistants that were in the area, especially with the talk that we would be operating out of. Yeah, once we started rolling out on missions, it was that second mission where that first IED hit. And I was like, oh, okay, this is real. And, you know, I would look back on it now. It's like that thing was, it wasn't even close. It was out in the middle of a field. Like,
yeah,
we would obviously experience much worse days than that. Yeah, that first one was, that was the moment. I'm like, okay, well, we're going to be in this for the next year. So let's see what happens. But
what type of, and did you feel this, that you were this type of person? What type of person is best suited to be a medic? Because that is not an easy job.
You know, this is something I talked to after we got back from Iraq, just kind of jumping forward was, and we had a lot of lessons learned, right, after that deployment. But yeah, I'd had conversations with the new medics, you know, because a lot of the medics that I deployed with, either PCS or ETS right after that deployment, it was a brutal one. But, you know, it takes an individual that, you know, if you're going to be a good medic, especially in a combat scenario, it's all about trust, right? Those guys have to trust you. Because in the worst moments, right, you hope that you're never going to be in those situations. But again, if you're, you know, if you're in a forward operating area, there's a good chance, especially back then, that you are going to have to work. And those guys need, you know, they need to be able to look at you and know, okay, this guy, he's squared away. Like, I trust him. And that's obviously extremely significant. So how you go about your day to day, I think, is really important, you know, in that position. Because again, if you're all torn up and you're constantly late for formations and you just, you know, you have to be a professional soldier to a certain degree as a medic. Because again, I think that's where the trust has to start. And then obviously you have to prove your worth as you go through it, right? Like, one of my NCOs in the platoon I ended up joining, prior to deployment, refused to call me doc. Right. Like he's like, you haven't earned that title yet. And that was an eye-opening experience for me as well. We got out to NTC, which is the National Training Center, prior to that deployment. And there were some scenarios that got played out and I was, you know, I got called on to work and, you know, it was after that mission, he came back. He's like, all right, you're good, doc. Like, and that was the first time that he, you know, I was actually able to earn that title and it's an earned title. Right.
Yeah.
So you have to be, obviously, you have to care. You can't be afraid to get in there and actually want to take care of these guys. And it's not just the physical side either. There's other roles that can be played from the emotional support piece. It's a complex position, if you will. But ultimately you have to care about wanting what's best for the guys, and know how to make the hard decisions, in a split second, that could end up depending, you know, and I didn't know if I was that guy, but I knew that was the job that I wanted to do. There was another.
That's sort of like the base question almost that I have for you. Like that, I want to be that guy. Like, where did that drive come from? Where did that initial decision come from?
I'll be honest. I was still coaching, you know, in the news reports back then, it was constant, right? And I think that was where I just kind of questioned, you see the faces on TV every night or every other night, we lose another soldier, we lose another Marine, whatever the case may be. Right.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I was like, I can help. I think I can do something.
Yeah.
That's the guy. I knew I wasn't going to be a gun toting, you know, heavy hitting, you know, infantry. That wasn't who I was. But I knew I wanted to help. So medic just made complete sense to me. And that was, it was, you know, I think it's dangerous, right? 'Cause you're like, it's not egotistical, but it's just like, man, if I can help keep one of those faces off the news, right? Like just one, that's worth it. So
Totally.
that's really where it came from.
So there is a really fine line in that job. This, like you said, emotional support and being able to be a soldier but do the job, and being able to sort of compartmentalize within a mission and do what you have to do without with removing the emotion from it. How did you navigate that really fine line?
Well, unfortunately, not, I mean, I think we were, you know, a little over a month in. It was actually Christmas Day. We lost our first guy, and it was from my platoon. You know, we were out on mission, we got ambushed. It was a pretty gnarly event. It was a coordinated attack. We know for a fact it was actually, there were three areas that they were hitting us from. It was at that moment that I knew that fight or flight kind of kicks in. And from the emotional side of it, not from the physical side of it, the emotional side of it. From that point on, I had shut off all feelings. And I've talked about that a lot, with a lot of our guys. It's, we all did the same thing. You just kind of go cold, because you have to. You know, we were not even, we were barely a month into full-blown operations, and we already lost our first guy. We knew it was only going to get worse. We could see it, the tendencies, everything was ticking up. So you don't lose the ability to care for the guys, but at the same time, you almost have to become emotionless, which for me, I'm a hard on the sleeve type of guy. I always have. That's how I coach. That's how I competed as an athlete. That was very strange to have to go to that place. And, you know, lo and behold, it took me about 5 years to actually come fully out of that numbness, after deployment. So, but that, it's one of those techniques you have to learn. You just learn the hard way. Like you have to develop that. Otherwise you can't make it through those, you know, a year long deployment. That's just going to be an emotional roller coaster because of everything you're going to go through. So, and that we, a lot of the guys had those conversations, where it's just like, yeah, you got to shut them off.
And we don't have to press too heavy on this. I wanted to lay some groundwork because Dogs for Our Brave is doing such great work with our returning service members and those who are going through either PTSD or different types of trauma. So we'll get to that shortly. I want to sort of at least bookend your time in Iraq. How did you end up coming back?
So we came back in, what was it, November, late October, early November, of 06. It was a very long year. We were involved in a lot of IED blasts. We were very, so the EFP phase, which were a lot of the IEDs coming over from Iran, the EFPs were just killers. That was, you know, they were doing serious damage to the A1 Abrams, which had never happened in the history of our, you know, our warfare at that point. That was the first time where the Abrams had shown some vulnerability, and that was pretty terrifying. My vehicle was hit with one, in September of 06. I'm exceptionally fortunate to even be sitting here right now. Piece of it cleared my, you know, part of the vehicle by about 6 inches. There was copper residue directly over my head. Fortunately, it was a pretty nasty concussion. Got thrown into the back of the vehicle, but other than that, everybody was fine. We had an injury in the lead vehicle, but it was a long deployment. We lost four guys, sent quite a few home with some significant injuries, several amputees. So, you know, we headed, you know, we headed out, and again, late October, early November. And it was a transition when we came home. It took me a while to realize how hard I was taking it.
And I wanted to take a quick side note of the EFP, explosively formed projectile, and what was that actually hit your vehicle? Like, what what type of explosive is it? Is just like a bomb attached to a
So,
rocket? Is it, you know?
no, it's an IED. It's just a very
Okay.
advanced form of IED. We were actually a block north of Sadr City that night. It was in the middle of the night. It was 10, I don't know, something. Yeah. I mean, it was 2,300 hours roughly when we got hit. But yeah, it was, you know, there was a six array, I believe, is what they feel it was. But the EFPs are, they have copper cones on the inside of them, right, with explosives hidden behind each one, right? And then they build them out however they build them out. It could be four of them, it could be six of them, could be eight, could be 10. It depends on how big they are, right? Pretty sure this one was daisy chained, which means there was another IED connected. They actually hit our lead vehicle first, which is what caused us to stop. I was in the Buffalo, which is a massive mine searching vehicle. It's got the big robotic arm. I was that night, I was actually in that vehicle. Normally I'm in a vehicle behind with the platoon sergeant, but that night I was in the Buffalo. So of course, with the medic being, you know, in that vehicle, we had to move up to the lead vehicle for me to render care. Upon rolling up, obviously we continue to scan our area, 525s. I actually looked out the window. I'm scanning and I could see a wire. I mean, it was almost like it was glowing. It was gnarly. And I screamed, you know, over the radio. I called Iron Claw, stop. He hit the brakes. As soon as he hit the brakes, I can still see the fireball coming at my face. But it detonated right there. It was maybe 10 feet away. They don't know if it was angled incorrectly, but it went right over the roof. It actually blew the front of the Buffalo. It blew the engine apart. So everybody in the vehicle was fine. I just did a backflip. The window bowed, punched me in the side of the head because obviously I'm, you know, almost right up against it looking. Did a backflip into the end, but yeah, very. So when the copper, it essentially forms a copper rock bullet, if you will, right? It doesn't matter the armor. It's so hot, the heat is so intense. Most vehicles burn immediately when they're hit by an EFP. Fire is usually the biggest issue when it comes to EFPs. And we know for a fact those were being created and manufactured in Iran, and they're being shipped over. So those were always the ones we were most concerned with, because we knew the damage that they would inflict. Obviously, if they can take the turret off an A1 Abrams, that's terrifying. So yeah, I know how lucky I'm exceptionally lucky. There's no other way to look. I mean, I'm just lucky. Because, you know, if it's 6 inches lower, I'm gone. And probably quite a few of the guys in the vehicle are gone as well. So, had a nice little concussion, but after they picked me up and kind of brought me to, I was able to go back and get and go to work and you know, take care of the gunner and the lead vehicle that just had luckily just had a, you know, a hand injury that I was able to treat, and then I went ahead and threw up for a few hours with a concussion that was
Wait,
pretty significant.
so it knocked you out, and when you came to, you then had to do your job. You didn't, you, it wasn't like, you know, let's get you a evac. It was no, right into it.
No, I was fine. It
Was
was
there
just, you know.
further contact at that point, or just the explosion and then dealing
No,
with the aftermath?
there was some random gunfire, but nothing that was imminent. So, but we sat out there for multiple hours. We were just outside Sadr City, which was not a great place to be in that
No.
time of the war. So, it was pretty nerve-wracking. Just sitting out there waiting for QRF and whatnot to show up. We had no air support. So we just kind of sat out there and, you know, hope for the
Hunkered
best
down.
until, well, because we knew we were going to have to have wreckers on site to remove the vehicles and whatnot. So, yeah, it was a long wait. But those, you know, after I was able to render care, the concussion hit pretty heavily. The guys were like, "Doc, you good?" And I'm like, "Eh, I'm
Okay.
fine. I'm going to go out
Yeah.
here and vomit for a while. But other than that, I'm good." So,
Damn.
yeah, it was, you know, it,
So flashing
unfortunately.
back to coming back, you said you didn't realize how hard you were taking it. How hard you were taking that specific incident or sort of the course of the entire year?
The whole deployment,
Okay.
right? Yeah, it was emotional. You know, I think that's where, again, being a medic, and you know, I know it's hard on all of us. The medics, I know, you know, the good medics that are out there, and we were fortunate to have, you know, our entire medical unit, you know, all 10 of us were outstanding. I mean, we fed off each other. We learned from each other. We constantly talked about, you know, lessons learned while we were out on missions, whatnot. So exceptionally fortunate to have that type of support internally. Yeah, just the overall stress of that year. You know, I think my platoon, it was somewhere like 60 something IEDs found.
Oh, wow.
Sometimes they found us. Sometimes right. We found them.
Yeah.
Got caught in a few ambushes, whatnot, but just the stress level that time of the war was pretty significant, right? There was heavy, heavy clashes between the Sunnis and Shias. So, I mean, at that point, we were essentially caught in the middle of a civil war. Mm-hmm. It was just, there was a lot of stress every time we rolled outside the wire. So learning how to decompress from that was exceptionally challenging. Mm-hmm. And knowing that we were most likely going to be spun up again to have to deploy within the next year. And that's exactly what happened. I was able to hide most of my symptoms from, you know, the anxiety, the PTSD, for a while. Again, outside of, you know, I'd drive to PT every morning, usually have to pull over, and I'd just get sick, just from the anxiety, just pure panic attacks. Obviously I didn't know it at the time, but that's what it was. And that was on the daily. But it really wasn't until, a few months later, we were sitting in a battalion meeting or a staff meeting. And I just exploded on First Sergeant. I don't even remember what the context of the meeting was, but I lost my cool, which was pretty rare for me at that point. I was typically pretty, you know, I understood military bearing. I was very blessed to have an incredible chain of command. And top didn't really press the issue in the meeting other than just kind of look at me sideways. But after the meeting, our offices were next to each other. You know, he was like, "Hey, Doc, why don't you come on in the office? Let's have a chat." And, I walked in, closed the door. And he's like, "All right, what's going on?" So, I broke down. I told him, I said, I'm hurting. I don't know where to go. I can't sleep. The nightmares were pretty terrible. The anxiety was pretty terrible. So it was at that point that I, you know, finally sought help. And that was the most important thing I've ever done.
So when you say that you didn't know where to go, was part of the reason to hide it was to keep your job and rank and, or for fear of being looked down? Like, what sort of made you decide, like, I have to keep this contained?
I didn't know any better.
Yeah, fair.
You know, I'm wearing the uniform. Mm-hmm. I'm a soldier, right? That's our job. Yeah. We go to war. We see terrible things. Deal with it, right? Which, that's not what was being pushed out. It was just, you wear your uniform, that's kind of the expectation, right? That's what you assume. Like, you know, they don't talk a lot about that. Like, how do you deal with that piece of it? It wasn't coming from chain of command. It wasn't coming from anywhere. It's just, it was the job, right?
And in that sort of culture, not to demean the culture, but in that culture of just like, you see everybody sort of pushing forward. Is there like this sort of need or want to like, I'll stay lockstep. I'll make sure that, you know, I'm good.
Yeah. And that's, you know, and being a medic, and at that point I essentially was leading the battalion, you know, from the medic point of view, because again, a lot of the other, you know, medics that I served with at that point, you know, in that previous deployment had all PCS'd or ETS'd. So I was the senior ranking medic at that time. So all the new medics coming in, that was my responsibility to start training them up. Cause we had already been told we were going to redeploy within, you know, a year. And I think once that news hit, that really started spinning me into a bad place. I couldn't admit it, but the thought of going back over at that point, it was terrifying. It was terrifying because of what everything we had gone through. And I was like, God, I'm not ready to do, like, I don't know if I'm ready to do that again. Because again, the intensity of what our responsibility was, especially as a medic, right? Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, what I was alluding to earlier was, as I get these new medics that come in, and they're young and they don't really know what they're doing. And I was brutally honest with them at that point. I'm like, guys, you know, we had some, you know, one or two that had some behavior type situations. And I'm like, doesn't cut it. Right. Because we'd go to events and there'd be, you know, battalion events, company events, whatnot. And you'd see the families. And I'd take that opportunity to point out and be like, that wife, those kids, you're the responsible one. When we go back over, you're the one that's going to have to play a huge role in making sure that they're, you know, their husband, their dad, whatever, you know, they come back home. You can't ever forget the awesome responsibility that you have, as a medic, that it's so critical. So that stress alone, if you're doing the job right, it's going to take its toll on you.
Absolutely. And that's like something that you, right. And that's something that that person can't, it's almost like becoming a parent. Like you can't comprehend what that, how you're going to instantly have to realize this massive responsibility you have until you suddenly are holding it or you're suddenly in it. So it's like, you know, I can imagine the responsibility that you had even attempting to try to get that across, like pound that into their head, but it's not going to fully get there until they're right there in the moment on the battlefield. Right.
Yeah. That was, you know, that was some of the best advice I got even before I went to basic training. Mm-hmm. You know, I had spoken to a Vietnam veteran who was a neighbor and he was just like, Brian, don't like every experience, you know, each individual is going to have their own experience, right? Go in with no expectations. It's not going to be like this. It is going to be like this, like blank slate. And that's how I entered the military was I'm just going to take it as it comes. Especially once I deployed, like I can listen to, you know, feedback, whatnot. And I'm not talking about like tactical pieces or, you know, the actual medical training, but just the overall experience.
Yeah.
I'm not going to understand that until I'm actually immersed in it. Right. Because my experience and what I go through is going to be completely different from what, you know, this individual goes through or this individual goes through. So
yeah,
everybody has their own path. So I was also very open with, you know, any of the medics I was leading at that point was like, I just need you to understand how critically important you are and what your job entails. And again, it goes back to the trust piece, right? Like if you're all jacked up and you're late for, you know, you don't look the part of a soldier, especially as a medic, those guys aren't going to trust you. Right. I talked to him about, you know, obviously young guys, they like to go out and party and have a good time, whatnot. Before I deployed, you know, and in college, I like to have a really good time, right? Like, it's like, let's just be honest. But when I got to the unit, and I guess because I got to the unit and already knew we were deploying, I didn't go out and I didn't party with any of the guys. I didn't drink with any of them. I didn't do any of that just because I felt like there was that separation, right? When we came back, I did hang out with a lot of, but I hung out with the guys that I deployed with, right? Because at that point, the bond was just, it's just different, right? It's totally different. So, you know, just trying to hammer all those points home to these younger guys of like, you have to understand that every action you take moving forward is going to impact what potentially happens when you're downrange, good, bad, or indifferent. So you have to be aware. So trying to take some of those lessons learned and move them forward to those guys. So I ended up being held back on that next deployment. And my chain of command again was rock solid. They gave me the choice, honestly. They knew I was a mess. And I think, you know, it's something I'll never not think about. But I knew from a maturity point of view, like I was mature enough to know emotionally, I wasn't able to go do my job. And my fear was that the anxiety that I dealt with, the PTSD, whatever you want to call it, in the most critical moment, I would freeze.
Yeah.
And that scared the hell out of me. Because that's somebody's life that potentially is on the line and I'm not able to do my job. How do I live with myself at that point?
Well, especially because your original idea of getting in was, I want to save, even if I save one.
Yeah.
That was like, you know, the juxtaposition there between that first deployment leaving and this one now. Yeah, I completely, in my own civilian way, can understand that like, if I can't save that one because of me, then I can't do that.
Yeah, and it's just one of those things. It's like, I can't just suck it up and push through this. Because then look at, being selfish for my, I knew I would never be the same. I don't know if I would ever have a chance to be the same again. I knew I had already changed permanently after that first appointment, which was, it is what it is. You put the uniform on, right? Like, I knew I would not, I hoped I would not be the same person I was when I prior to enlisting to the point when I got out, right? What that change looked like, I didn't know because I had to go through it. But at that point, I definitely knew if I tried to suck it up and go through that deployment, I didn't know how I was going to come out on the other end.
Did you feel like you completed that first initial personal reason for getting in, saving that one person out of that first deployment that you did? Did you feel like you did the best you could to complete that personal mission?
Absolutely. I don't regret anything. I'd enlist. I'd do it all over again. It's the most important thing I've ever done in my life. Especially from a lessons learned, a maturity, a discipline, a character building. I mean, you name it, right? Every experience is an opportunity to learn, right? Even the hardest ones are the most important, negative, positive, however you want to phrase it, right? Those experiences are our lives. If we're not willing to look back at those and really re reflect, we're missing such a huge opportunity to grow as a human being. So yeah, I mean, I feel I know I poured myself into that job. I was all in. Obviously, you have to be all in. So yeah, it was mission accomplished from what when I enlisted, I knew. When I in essentially once I was being medically discharged, and I had re-enlisted. I'd actually put in my packet for PA school, and my chain of command was extremely supportive of pushing me to get into PA school. I was on orders to go work at Burke Army Medical Center at the at that point the burn unit had just opened. So I was I was all in on trying to make this a career. But unfortunately, I just, when push came to shove and I really got into, the therapy and trying to better myself, it was a rough deployment. We saw a lot.
Absolutely.
And I was terrified how far down that rabbit hole I would go if I continued on with my service.
So that sort of does that path then lead you to Dogs for Our Brave? Like, how did you?
No, I so okay, so I've been a coach. That's what I did prior to enlisting. I grew up playing volleyball. I grew up playing all sports, right? But I coached collegiate volleyball. I played in college. I'd started a club in St. Louis. That's where I'm from. I'm actually at the convention center right now for a massive event. After I came back, I knew the medical field was out, unfortunately. Because I had considered, was I going to be a, was I going to go into the paramedic route? Was I, I just knew I couldn't do it after what I saw, unfortunately. And I loved the medic. I love helping. But, again, now I'm 46 years, about to be 46 tomorrow, right?
Hey,
Like,
happy
I know
birthday.
who I am. Thank you. I know who I am. I know I enjoy taking care of people. Whether it's from the coaching aspect of helping kids grow and learn the sport and become, good young men, citizens, go out and make a positive impact in the world, whether it's the military side of things, as a medic, take like physically and emotionally taking care of guys, either, whether it's a leader, developing coaches and helping them grow and learn and mature. I know that's who I am, right? I like that life of, that servant leadership. That's who I am, right? That's what drives me. That's what fills my cup. So after I got out, I knew I was going to go back to coaching because we had started this club. That was my passion, right? That was a blessing for me, right? Because I'm sure you're aware, so many individuals get out of the service and they have absolutely no clue what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that feeds into a lot of the serious problems that we're dealing with right now, because that's where you turn to alcohol, you turn to drugs, you turn, you name it, any of the vices, right?
Right.
Gambling, porn, whatever, right? The suicide piece, because again, they had this specific goal, this specific mission, this specific purpose, and poof, it's gone. Now what do I do?
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of them just don't have that. I was very fortunate to have an incredible support system at home. My family, my, what would be my wife, right? Who we met as I was getting out of the service. And then obviously the volleyball community as well. Being able to get back into coaching immediately. I started coaching at another university, ended up taking over, you know, the boys program for the club that I had helped start prior to enlisting. And that's what I've been doing for the last 15-ish years, right? Was coaching, you know, running a program that, you know, had upwards of 24 boys teams every single year that traveled all over the country. And I got to lead those coaches, those players, and really find my confidence again. Because obviously that was, it took a hit. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know if I was a quitter for having been medically discharged and retired from the Army. There's a lot of self-doubt there. And I'm sure I'm not the only one that goes through that, right? Even though I knew I was probably making the best decision for myself, you had to question, did I fail? Like, as you know, did I fail the mission? And those are really challenging times. But volleyball saved my life, right? Being back into coaching saved my life, because it gave me that sense of purpose and that sense of direction. And again, it was my other passion, right? So I got to go from one passion of taking care of, you know, the soldiers to back into the gym, taking care of the guys and the coaches and whatnot. So that's what I've been doing for 15 years. And lo and behold, you know, Dogs Far Brave kind of fell into my lap about 7 months ago. I'd been following the organization for several years. A dear friend of mine who actually coaches with me, but we had known each other since we were kids. He and his now fiance had introduced me to the organization. He's like, Brian, he's like, I know you're kind of picky about the VSOs you want to support, but he's like, these guys, their mission is, it's pretty awesome, right?
Yeah.
And I'm a huge dog lover, animal lover. I have three dogs, I have horses, I have chickens, right? So, I'd been following the organization for a couple of years. And
are any of your three dogs a service animal?
No, they're not. They're not. It's just, you know, I could probably benefit from one, but just having all of them, I think they do their job, right?
Yeah.
It was a chance meeting. Things just, when things happen, you know, I think there's one thing I've learned when an opportunity presents itself, you got to take advantage of it. Right. I think that's something I've been pretty good at in my life, is not looking past some great opportunities that have been presented to myself. And this was one of them. I felt like maybe it was a time for change in what I'd been doing, which is exceptionally hard because I love coaching so much. But at the same time, we know, we've seen over the years how badly the veteran community is hurting, right?
Yes.
How hard I navigated through some pretty tough times, which my wife can attest to, and my, some of my family and friends can attest to, right? It was a struggle. It was a real struggle. I wasn't immune to those. We've lost a lot of guys from our unit, whether directly to suicide or indirectly to alcohol, drugs, you name it. And then just the state of the country, right? There's a lot of angst there, especially for the veterans. It constantly weighs. Even though you push it aside and you continue to go on day-to-day life. But that hurt is always there, because you see how much it's struggling within the veteran community.
Yeah.
So when this opportunity presented itself, I knew it created a chance for me to be Doc again and get back in the fight, and take care of these guys in any way I could.
I love that. At the same time, defining it that way.
And that's what I saw it as, right? It's not a job. It's just an opportunity to complete another mission. It was hard to walk away from what I'd been doing, because I do care about these kids and their parents and the relationships I've built. But at the end of the day, I knew that we need as many of us as possible to get out and get back in the fight to help our fellow veterans and the country in general. Mm-hmm. And if I can do that through, dogs, I'm all in, right? I'm all in. So that's ultimately how this all kind of just fell into place. But it made sense to me, right? It was the opportunity that fell into my lap and I'm like, nope, this is the direction I have to go. My wife was completely supportive of the situation. I had some hard conversations with some very dear friends. But everybody supported me because they knew it was the right move. I fully believed in the mission of Dogs for Our Brave. But I also knew that I had a great opportunity to step in and help grow the organization, not necessarily with size, but impactfulness, right? Yeah. I'm the first veteran on staff. So I knew I had a different perspective that they weren't really aware of. Right.
Totally.
So that's kind of how I fell into it. And again, only being there 7 months, right. It's been a journey so far. And I feel like I'm just now getting my feet set to understand my vision for the organization and what I can bring to the table. That takes time. But I feel like over the last month, that's really started to flush out for me. I'm a planner. I'm a visionary. It's kind of how I am as a program, as a program director for a big, athletic club. It was like, okay, where do we want to go? How do we get there? Mm-hmm. Same piece with the veteran side of things within the organization. I needed to kind of wrap my brain around where we were, who we are now, and where do we want to go? And how can I help be a part of that? So it's exciting times right now. Great challenge. Because there's a lot of hard work.
Yep.
I've come to be very comfortable with pointing out, like, everybody loves the dog piece and they're like, this is so great. It's rainbows, unicorns, dogs, veterans. And I'm like, you're right. It is. Now I'm going to smack you in the face with some reality. And I'm going to talk to you about the hard things that we're dealing with. Right. Because I think everybody deep down knows how hard working within the veteran community is and the seriousness of what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. But until you really have the hard conversations, it's kind of hard. It's kind of easy to kind of color over it with like how great the mission is and how great the work is. Cause it is, right. But it is challenging. Right. But that's where the reward and the fulfillment comes in, is when we can actually impact significant change in just one veteran's life. Right. Because there's a ripple effect there. There's a ripple effect with hopefully within their family, right? And then there's that ripple effect hopefully within their community. And ultimately, that's the goal, is as the veteran within the organization, I want to help our veterans that we're serving become the best version of themselves again. Through purpose, through mind, body, spirit, holistic training, right? Holistic healing. That's the focus. Because the more we can do that, as a whole, right? Whew. There's so many veterans out there that possess incredible strength that they've lost sight of. They don't recognize the struggles that we've gone through, the things that we've seen. It actually creates an inner level of strength that we have to unlock with a lot of our veterans, mm-hmm. which means they have to deal with the hardest of moments. They've got to process it. They've got to accept it. They've got to learn how to live with it and then use that perspective to have positive change within themselves, mm-hmm. their family, their caregivers, whoever's closest to you. And then if that ripple effect continues, right? The veteran community as a whole, if we can start doing that, whew, what type of change can we make in this country? I mean, the positive change we can make in this community it can be so significant, but there's a lot of hard work that still has to be done on that front.
Absolutely.
And if I can play a little role in that, I'm here to play a little role in that.
So I'm going to go down to brass tacks on Dogs for Our Brave. What is the specific mission? How long have they been around? And what is the main thrust of the work that you guys do?
So we started about 10 years ago, 2014. We were founded by Marilyn and Andy Gladstein. So they, ironically, at that time, they were living out in California. Andy had befriended what would he would come to find out was a Navy SEAL, but he was also one of the commanders with a Navy SEAL unit out there. But they became friends, and through conversations, whatnot, Andy was having to talk about, he was looking to buy Maryland something special for their, I believe it was their 36th wedding anniversary. And the individual had stated, you know, well, I'm going to tell you what you're going to do. You're going to go buy a dog. You're going to have that dog professionally trained. And then that dog is going to, you're going to find a injured combat veteran to give that dog to as a gift. And that dog's going to be, you know, work as a service dog. Andy was like, great. How do I go about doing that? He's like, I don't know, man, you're the one with all the ideas. Like, you figure it out. So that's exactly what Andy and Marilyn did. It's been a process. I know the first 5 or 6 years, I believe, they essentially were training one dog at a time through a trainer in Arizona. In 2019, they moved the base of operations to St. Louis, Missouri, which is where we are now. Their daughter, Sarah, and their son both live in the area. Sarah became heavily involved in the organization because of her work with CareVet, which leads to a lot of great opportunities for us as an organization. But they bought a facility in the city of St. Louis, where we're currently residing and operating our base of operations out of. And it's been expanding ever since then, right? We've been flushing out the mission since then, and we're still very much in that mode of getting the administrative piece set, right? Because our mission is very challenging in how we operate. So our focus is, number one, we rescue our dogs from local shelters. So we save a veteran, we save a dog, right? Save two lives at once. We train that dog to become, we specialize in mobility assistance, right? Which is pretty rare. There aren't a lot of service dogs, organizations out there that provide that. So the mobility assistant piece takes anywhere from, you know, 15 to 18 months to complete training. So it's significant. But the, you know, the most important piece is we cover all the costs for the life of the dog. We cover training costs. We cover veterinary costs. We cover food costs. Wow. Our veteran will never pay a dime for anything. So the funding side of it is very significant for us, right? Mm-hmm. It's anywhere from, you know, the life of a dog, it's, you know, $100,000 to $150,000. You know, it's not insignificant. So that's a challenge, right? So, you know, we're still working through a lot of that, but obviously the organization is in, we're growing. You know, they bring me on board. So, you know, we have, you know, three administrator, actually we'll have four, because there was just another significant hire. She's going to start in a few weeks and she's exceptional. So, we have our executive director, our director of training, who handles all of our dog training piece. She has seven trainers underneath her. Myself as director of veteran services. And then we have our board as well. So, you know, organizationally, we're in a really good position to continue to structure ourselves to ensure, you know, the bottom line is what we're taking care of our veterans. Right. So, but because of our mission and how we operate, it's substantial. It's a lot of work behind the scenes, because we're invested in these individuals' lives for the long run. Right.
Yeah.
It's the life of a dog, but it's actually the life of a veteran. Right. Mm-hmm. So when we approve and bring a veteran into the organization, we're going to be a part of that veteran's life for the next 8, 10, 20, 30 years. Who knows, right? That's the goal. Because it's, you know, if they, you know, as they have a service dog, if that dog needs to be retired or the dog passes away, they have the opportunity to receive another dog from us. So it's a big mission, which is, it's a complex mission, which is where the challenge comes in, which I love. That's why we're here, right? I knew this wasn't going to be easy. So we're putting in the work.
How can people support it? Where do they go?
So our website, dfob.org, creates a, you know, we have a ton of great information on there, a lot of great videos, a lot of great testimonials from veterans that we have in the organization already. There's ways to get involved from a funding piece, from a volunteer piece. So it's dfob.org. We're also on all the social media sites, Facebook, Instagram, X, formerly Twitter, whatever the case may be. But you get a lot of information on there as well. But our website contains a ton of information on how you can get involved as well.
Of the friends that you deployed with, do any of them have service animals?
I don't know if any do or not. That's a good question. I know there's a lot of them out there that need them. But you know, and I've had quite a few guys, you know, when they see it posted on social media and whatnot, that I had taken, and I had reached out to quite a few of them as well, just kind of give them an update that this is what I'm doing now. Cause obviously the more conversations we have within the veterans community, that's super important. Right. So I've tried to put it out there, but, because obviously if there's anybody that I can help that makes sense, I want to do that.
But what that means, I guess, right? What I'm getting at then is like sort of a testimonial of you talked with another veteran who has one, and just like, what change did that elicit in their life? Did that give them more comfort, more ease of use of their house, able to leave the house, things like that?
That's a huge part of it, right? It all depends. So like for our veterans, you know, within, you know, the DFOB family, it's significant. It's life-changing, right? And I love Bridget, our director of training. She says it all the time, right? These dogs are not meant to make your life easier. They're meant to make your life better. It's a resource, right? It's a tool. There's still so much work that the veteran has to put in. So ultimately, what does that supply them with? Purpose, right? Which we've talked about is a loss for a lot of them. They don't have that purpose ever, especially if they're significantly wounded physically or emotionally, right?
Yeah.
They really struggle finding that purpose again. So the dog can help become a resource for that purpose, because they have to learn how to handle the dog properly. They have to take care of the dog on a daily basis, right? Mm-hmm. So the better equipped they are to do that, the more they're going to get out of that resource, right? Yeah. Obviously, the dog itself provides an incredible amount of love and relationship building, and just that comfort, right? Allowing them to go out in public again, which quite a few of them didn't want to go out in public because they were terrified to go out in public. It was challenging, right? So having a buddy with them makes a significant impact, right? Again, you go on our website and you see some of these testimonials. I've watched them, I don't even know how many times, and I'll still flip and cry every time, right? And I know these guys now. I talk to them. I try to talk to them on a weekly basis, right? So, but it's still just seeing the impact it's made on them. It's absolutely significant, right? So we see that, and it just, what does it do? It just motivates us to work harder.
Absolutely. I have one more question for you, our audience. You'll find links to Dogs for Our Brave right below in the description, whether you're listening on audio or you're watching here on YouTube. Brian, I really want to thank you so much for your time today and for sharing your story. And one thing that's sort of a theme that I sort of noticed over the course of our conversation was that you always wanted to be there for that one, be there for that one. Who was the person that saved you, do you think, when you were, you know, when you came back, when you were having that hard, difficult transition, who was that person for you?
I don't think I can name everybody. I don't know if I have time to name everybody. You know, it's just the general support of my family, my friends, my now wife, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it was a group effort. And I think that's, again, I was very fortunate to have that group effort. Mm-hmm. I think that's what we're trying to be for those that don't have that in their lives. But that's the veteran community in general. One of the most important things I do is I try to reach out to other VSOs and have as many conversations and build those relationships, because as an organization, we can't do, like, we're just a piece of the puzzle, right? Yeah. If we're going to win this war, especially for the suicide piece and just the general veteran community, the struggles that are going on, how do we win a war, right? We need infantry. We need air support. We need medics. We need cooks, right? We need logistics, you name it, right? We need all those things. It's the same thing now that we're out in this fight. We need all these. There's so many great VSOs out there. There's so many great organizations that want to help veterans. And I know a lot of veterans out there are jaded, because there are some organizations out there that are not on the up and up, and we've heard about them, right? And they've burned us, and they've burned bridges, and we're already struggling enough, so that can turn veterans away.
Yeah.
I can tell you for certain, I've had so many incredible conversations with individuals that genuinely care, and they want to help, and they want to be that community for those individuals that don't have that community in their lives, right? That mm-hmm. don't have that one individual or those several individuals that can help get them through whatever they're going through and help them find that purpose again, to get back in and again, just become the best version of themselves, right? It wasn't one person for me. I don't think it's one person for anybody. So I'd be remiss if, you know, but with my family, my parents, my sisters, my brother, my in-laws, right? My wife, you name it, right? They all played a role. But ultimately, at the end of the day, that veteran has to own their life again and be able to take control and be like, enough. Like, I want to get back out there. I want to start living again. I want to take what I learned and I want to turn it into positive. So I think a lot of us have to give our credit to ourselves, and that's really hard. Some of us don't, we beat ourselves up internally pretty easily. So for any of those guys that are out there, men, women, veterans that are struggling, like, the strength's there. You have it inside of you. So lean on the support systems that you have, because they're out there. We're going to flip this thing around, and we're going to start seeing a lot of positivity in our veteran community moving forward.
It's a great message to end on. I can't think of a better one. Brian, again, thank you so much for being a part of the Scuttlebutt today. I'm hoping to get the message out about Dogs for Our Brave far and wide. And to our audience, please check them out any way you can. And if you can give assistance or donate or however you'd like to Dogs for Our Brave, check out their website. Again, the link is below. And also, please like, share, subscribe, and ring the bell on YouTube for the Scuttlebutt so you're the first to know whenever we release new episodes. And you can always reach out to me if you'd like to be connected with Brian, Shaun, S-H-A-U-N, at veteransbreakfastclub.org. Brian, would love to have you back on in the future. Talk about where Dogs for Our Brave has gone. That would be fantastic. And please, this is an open invitation for you to join any one of our open events that we had our host online. Or if you're ever in Pittsburgh, come on to an in-person breakfast. We'd love to have you.
Thanks, Shaun. I just appreciate the opportunity to get on and talk about something I think we're all passionate about, and that's just helping our veterans, which, you know, helping our country.
We're grateful for the support of UPMC for Life, a UPMC healthcare Medicare program. At UPMC Health Plan, their goal is to improve the health of their members. They can also help you make sense of Medicare, get the answers and information you need, such as how to choose the Medicare Advantage plan that's right for you. UPMC for Life offers a wide range of affordable Medicare Advantage plans, and you military veterans can save money and get more benefits with your Medicare plans. UPMC for Life has plans designed for veterans by veterans. The type of coverage you have from your service may help you decide which plan will be a good fit. If you have TRICARE for Life, UPMC for Life PPO Salute may be a good fit for you. You can view plan options, including their prescription drug coverage, compare costs, and learn about all the benefits you get when you choose UPMC for Life by going to upmchealthplan.com/Medicare. Thank you so much, UPMC for Life, for sponsoring the Scuttlebutt. Thank you for watching this episode of the Scuttlebutt. I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Tobacco Free Adagio Health. Tobacco Free Adagio Health has been supporting the podcast for quite some time now. We've been so pleased to be supported by them. They are dedicated to reducing and preventing tobacco use and getting the word out about the hazards of smoking and secondhand smoke. They're all about health, so they want people to quit. They have classes, nicotine replacement therapy, and a popular quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They also educate people, children especially, about tobacco use from cigarettes, cigars, pipes, chew, snuff, and other nicotine products like vaping. And finally, Tobacco Free Adagio Health advocates for public and private policies that ensure healthy places to live, work, and play. You can learn all about what Tobacco Free Adagio Health offers at tobaccofree.adagiohealth.org. Or you can check out the two Scuttlebutt episodes that featured Tobacco Free Adagio Health. We had a wonderful representative come on to the podcast, talk to us about all the classes and therapies that they offer. It was two wonderful conversations. So I definitely direct you to both of those if you want more information, or just call their free quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Thank you again, Tobacco Free Adagio Health, for your support.